Right, so morning everybody. Final lecture on heavy iron physics.
Alright. Good morning. So my apologies, because the slides are not printed out yet, because I just handed them in this morning, so there was no time to print them. So we're going to continue with where we left off yesterday. So yesterday I discussed briefly the non-perturbative aspects of QCD and why we think they're interesting and why we want to study them. And I went over the accelerators, the experiments, and I told you a little bit of the status of the field, basically when the SPS stopped taking data 10 years ago. So today we're going to continue with the current status, with what is being observed at RIC energies, and then we're going to see what we can do at LHC and talk a little bit about LHC. So this is still one of the main things we want to test, so the energy density versus temperature, the phase transition, and you have this characteristic increase in energy density due to the new degrees of freedom which become available, the quarks and the gluons, and you have the pressure which is connected via the equation of state with the energy. And so this was for an ideal gas. This is done on the lattice, so this is something we should trust much better. And here you see quantitatively the features which you would expect from simple arguments. One of the important things is as I mentioned before, is this relation between epsilon and P. So dP d epsilon, which is an ideal gas, is given by 1/3, which is the velocity of sound squared in a gas. But during the phase transition, that quantity changes rapidly because the pressure goes slower than the energy density. And that's something which is also calculated, something you can calculate on the lattice. So again, phase diagram. And this is the velocity of sound, so the derivative of these quantities. And here you indeed see the quantity expected for an ideal gas. You see that's something you also reach. Say around 2 TC, but around TC, velocity of sound drops dramatically. And just to remind you, that thing can reach up there. So if you create a heavy ion collision, you create a system which initially is very, very hot. So say at RIC energies is sitting somewhere here, and then it starts to expand and cool down. And so it probes this whole region of speed of sound velocity. So at the end, you will see something which is proportional to this whole time evolution. So how can you experimentally try to address that? Well, one of the simplest way to look at it is just look at the particle spectra. You know from statistical physics and thermodynamics that if you have a black body, you know how the spectrum looks like with a temperature. And if you plot the particle yield, you plot 1 over mt dn, mt as function of mt on a logarithmic scale, and mt is defined like this, right? So it's basically pt if you're in high enough transverse momentum, but a low momentum, the mass also kicks in. And for a purely thermal source, you just expect these things to be straight lines for all the particles. That's what is called this MT scaling. And that works very well for proton collisions. However, if you have a system which is not just, cannot be described just by a temperature, but also has a strong collective velocity, you get an additional component to the distribution of the spectra, and that's proportional to the mass of the particles. Right? It's like MV term which enters. And that is something which you also see in the spectra. So the light particles are hardly changed, still a straight line, but the heavier particles get boosted to higher momenta due to this collective velocity, and then you see this characteristic curvature in the spectrum. And this is something you can measure again. This is for still SPS energies, from the lightest particles to pions up to deuterium, which is measured. The pions, kaons, protons, lambda, cascade, omega. And at the yes, it still matters if you're looking at particles or antiparticles, because you still have a large baryon number, so it's plotted separately. But you clearly see that the shape of the spectra is indeed changing from this approximately straight line to something which gets a clear shoulder in the shape of the spectra. So this, and well, here you see the fit, so you get a temperature, a freeze-out temperature, and a collective flow velocity. Yeah?
So the lines here,
the points are there. That's right. And you also, so the lines are the theory, just the simple theory, the spectrum with these two components. It's hardly only theory. And you find a temperature which is around 100 MeV for the particles where they decouple, and they have a collective velocity which is half the speed of light at SPS energies. You also see that the spectrum is not described that well, certainly not at lower PT, because there are additional effects which come into play. And in general, you always have to wonder how the spectra also change in proton-proton. So you have to take a couple of additional things into account, which complicates this. So luckily, we also have an additional way to address these components and address the collective velocity. And that's something which I addressed yesterday with the reaction plane. So if you have a non-central heavy ion collision, so now we're looking in the transverse plane. This is the impact parameter between the two centers. We have the two heavy ions overlapping. You already see this almond shape. That's the zone which you create when they collide. And that's characterized usually by a so-called eccentricity. And if you would have all the collision points in here, all the partons or nucleons, you can calculate this eccentricity. And for a spherical source, this eccentricity becomes zero. And for something like this, you get a relative large value of the eccentricity. And now imagine that a heavy ion collision would just be a superposition of proton-proton collisions. Right? So here you have one proton-proton collision, another one, and many more. That's sort of the picture we have. And if that would be everything which would be happening in this thing, you still have this coordinate space distribution, so you have this almond. But you also see here already these arrows are meant to indicate the momentum space distribution. And while all these different proton-proton collisions can have sort of a favorite direction, so there can be more particles going in one, they don't have to be as mutually symmetric. If you put all of that together and look at the particles which are coming out of this heavy ion collision, so the superposition, you will get just a random emission of particles. And that's in big contrast if you would really create a system. So if it's not just a superposition of PP, but when it really becomes a complete system, because then you can talk about the energy density and the pressure gradient, and then you have a very high energy density in the center, and the energy density, of course, here is zero, so the vacuum. So you get a gradient which changes the gradient because the distance here is much shorter than here, so you have a much larger gradient in the direction of the reaction plane. So that's what you would get if you have the evolution as a bulk system, and you would get a flow, again, in both directions, but you would get stronger collective motion in the reaction plane. And that's something you can look at that's more differential. You will see more and faster particles in the plane. So if you would know the reaction plane, measure the reaction plane, you look at the particle distribution in a scenario like this, just flat, just uniform distribution, and if it's a system which collectively expands, you should expect something like this, and this is as a function of centrality. So for the more central collisions, you see this cos 2 phi shape. That's the largest contribution if you look at this element. If you go more peripheral, where the system becomes more asymmetric, you will see that eventually in the momentum space, also the particles become more asymmetric. So what we have is we have something which starts just in geometry, the system, and then due to interactions between the constituents, so that's the microscopic picture, build up pressure, the system starts to expand, and what you have in coordinate space transforms into momentum space and gives this azimuthal distribution, which is not uniform anymore. And the way you can characterize that is by looking at the mean cost to fire that distribution, and that's what we call the so-called Olympic flow. And because the system, when it starts to expand from this initial element, will become more and more spherical, so at some point during the evolution, this force which is pushing this will stop. So when it's spherical, basically you have no additional push anymore. And then what they call self-quenching, the difference in evolution stops. So this probe is also actually more sensitive to the early phase of the collision, because then you have the biggest asymmetry, the biggest driving force, and that's where most of the signal is coming. So it's a hadronic probe, which I told you yesterday is basically is just what you see at the end of the system, but it reflects the properties of the early time of the evolution. And that was one of the big things at RIG. It came out, that was the second paper which was produced at RIG. So it was just pretty much with the data of 2 days of running. That was the analysis we did for 30,000 events. And this is the outcome. So here you have this V2 parameter as a function. At that point, we plotted as n charge over n max. So the maximum number of particles observed at that point. Not everything was completely understood and calibrated. So we measured a particle distribution. You looked at the maximum number of particles which are produced, and that's the most central collisions. And then you bin, you look as a function of multiplicity compared to this maximum multiplicity. So you go from central collisions to peripheral collisions this way. For the most central collisions, the thing is spherical, so you expect a small V2 value, if at all. And more peripheral, you expect that this V2 value, if you create a system which is strongly interacting, will increase. And indeed, that's what's seen. That here, this is the data, the red dots. And you see from central to peripheral that it increases, and then when it becomes very peripheral, it starts to come down. That was a big surprise already, but especially the magnitude was the thing which nobody had predicted. At least nobody had predicted that would come out so close to the model. So this is ideal hydrodynamics. And then so you really have a system with zero viscosity, shear viscosity. And that gives the maximum flow values which you would ever be able to expect, depending on the equation of state. And that's illustrated with these boxes here. So this is the maximum flow from ideal hydrodynamics, and this is the data. So the data showed a very nice agreement for more central to mid-central collisions with ideal hydrodynamics, and afterwards started to deviate. And if you would try to look at that in hadron cascade, hadron transport models, these are the same distributions in hadron transport, and that's actually done many years after these measurements. So people have tried to tune all their hadron models as good as they could. But you see it's sort of the maximum values they are able to get for the more peripheral collisions are in the order of 2-2.5%, while the measurements are close to 7%. So there's really factors of. That's something which signature like this you cannot get in a hadronic transport code. So one can go and try to look in more detail, because what I showed was just the mean V2, so the integral of all these particles. But you, of course, you can look at that distribution as a function of transverse momentum and as a function of particle mass. This is a little bit how it would look like hydrodynamical picture. So there's a few components which go in there. I'm not going to focus on the equation, just tell you a little bit by showing the effects, what the important ingredients are. So what is driving this V2 as a function of PT, of course, is this difference of expansion in and out of the reaction plane. But the other thing which is also important, which you will see, is at what temperature the system freezes out. Because if the temperature is very high, a temperature gives you a large random motion. So if you have small collective motion and large temperatures, you won't see much of the collective motion at smaller dt because it's overwhelmed by the random motion of the temperature. So it tells you something about the freeze-out temperature. It also tells you something about the collective flow, the total amount of it. And it even tells you something about how the system looks like when it freezes out, if it's already become completely spherical or still has this almond shape. So these are the core parameters where you're certainly sensitive to. And this is to show you the effect. So this is again G2 as a function of this transverse momentum for two different species, pions and protons, just to take two masses. So you have the pions for the MeV, the protons 1GeV. And then you can vary the temperature, the freeze-out temperature, from 80 to 120 MeV. And what you see is that this is corresponding to the pion. So for light particles, when you change the temperature, the distribution also changes rapidly. And that you can easily understand, again, because of this random motion. And that has a big effect on the light particle that will start to move in more random direction. For a heavy particle like the proton, it doesn't do so much. And if you would go to even heavier, like the omega or charm particles, it would be even more similar. So you see that light particles change rapidly with changing temperatures. Heavy particles stay more or less the same. In contrast, if you look at the radial flow velocity, so the expansion velocity of the system, that is something where the heavy particles are more sensitive because that's amplified due to the mass. So it's basically the MV term which enters. So if you have a larger collective velocity, you see that from smaller to larger, you push out the particles, the pions, light particles, to higher PT. You can basically look for the same distribution. You would end up with a shift in PT due to this collective velocity. But for heavier particles, it's actually much, much bigger. And it's even characteristic negative here because you push it in a somewhat funny direction. But so you have quite a large sensitivity to all these parameters by just looking at these, if you would measure the pion and proton V2. And this is the other parameter. So if you have a difference in the reaction plane, the larger the difference, of course, the larger this V2 parameter becomes. And this is to show if the asymmetry at freeze-out is different, you would also see different values. So these are measurements, rather early measurements, of V2 as function of transverse momentum for pions, kaons, protons, lambdas, and cascades. So here you see the pions, kaons, protons, lambdas, and cascades. And then the lines are just a simple fit with this model where you have these four parameters. And you see you get a really nice description of the whole characteristics of that data, again, with one temperature, one radial flow velocity, and one difference as a variation of that velocity. In a model like hydrodynamics, these four parameters are not independent. They depend on your initial conditions, the density where you start off with, and the equation of state, the thing we're after. So in that, with a certain freeze-out temperature, that defines how big the radial flow velocity is, how big the difference in and out of plane is. So you can check that to see what equation of state does describe your data. And so this was the fit with a few parameters. But here you can see it with hydrodynamics and different equations of state. So taking just a so-called hadron gas equation of state, that still doesn't make it the same as a hadronic cascade, but it just uses an equation of state, which you would also have in a hadron gas. Or when you take into account this phase transition, and the characteristic thing, as I told you, is that the PD epsilon in the phase transition drops very rapidly over a large period of time. And then you see that indeed you get quite a different behavior for just I just showed here the pions and the protons to make a little bit clearer plot. But so this is the description one gets with this QGP equation of state, and this is what you get with the Hadron gas equation of state. So it's clear that with just these simple measurements, you get sensitivity already. You have to be a little bit careful in over-interpreting a plot like that, because, I mean, at first sight, you can say, okay, this is clear. You have a QGP equation of state, so you know everything you want to know. There are more uncertainties in the models, like the initial state and the distributions of the nucleons, which can change that distribution. So there are more parameters here. But this is just to illustrate that, in principle, you can see the differences between equations of state. Those were basically the ingredients which went into this, the highlights of the RIC experiments, together with the jet quenching, which is something I'll come back to in the next slide. So this is the summary of the four RIC experiments after the first 3 years of data taking. And the system which was seen was characterized instead of what people expected initially, like an ideal gas, quarks and gluons. It really started which would have a very, very high viscosity and would have very, very low flow values if you would measure it. So that's the picture people had initially. But now we saw that it really behaves like a fluid. It's really a very strong collective system, and it seems to expand with almost a zero shear viscosity, which is really dramatic. So this is our ideal gas, the non-interacting quarks and gluons, and this is how they try to depict it for something which is strongly interacting. So that also made a big splash in the media. But one of the more surprising things was the connection which was made ADS-CFT. This was used, was proposed by Malvasina as a dual QCD. But if you could, in a strongly coupled system, you can calculate things using gravity and then make the connection, use them as a dual to QCD. And that's only true if the system is really strongly coupled. And in a system like that, they calculated a lower bound on the shear viscosity. And they conjectured that for every conformal field theory that bound would exist. And the shear viscosity in dimensional units would be 1 over 4 pi as the lowest value. And that's pretty much the value which is observed at RIC energies from the flow measurements. And just to put it in perspective, so this is when you look at different systems as a function of temperature. This is the shear viscosity at over S. And in these units, the bound will be at 1. And this is then something like helium. And I actually looked it up. So this is what they call a superfluid helium. But I still don't know if can make the one-to-one connection, and in many places they indeed, for a superfluid, is just a shear viscosity which goes to zero. So this is helium, nitrogen, and water, and this is the bound. So for the most ideal system we know, most of the ideal system we know, they're at least 10 times above the bound in the properties. So we saw we had a very nice description with ideal hydrodynamics, but now we really want to quantify this number more precisely. So try to put an error on it and give a bound on the shear viscosity of the system which is created. And for that, the measurements have to become more and more precise. The theory also has to improve a lot. So you already could see that for lower energy, so that this shear viscosity, this ideal fluid, was something description which only worked for the more central collisions. That was clear from the first slide, from the integrated flow. So from more central to somewhat peripheral collisions, it worked, and then it starts to deviate. And that's even clearer illustrated here, when you take this V2 and you divide out this initial eccentricity of the system, so the driving force, and then if you would have ideal hydrodynamics, that would be just a straight line, because it just the system responds proportional to this eccentricity. And in the data, you see that that's not the case. It's basically decreasing if you go to smaller systems. So these are the more central systems, and here the more peripheral. And actually, if you plot it like this in multiplicity density, you can also put on different energies and different collider energies even. So then you have the smaller systems at lower energies and the larger systems at high energies. So you see that for smaller systems, it's certainly not this ideal fluid. There are effects, Fiske's effects. But the question is, you have this whole evolution. So you have the viscous effects, which can enter very early on for the square gluon phase, but you also have the hadronic phase, which is certainly very viscous. If you take a hadron gas and calculate the magnitude of the of shear in a system like that, that would be very large. So we still don't know if the shear viscosity, if you want to constrain just the magnitude of the QGP, you have to disentangle the two phases. The other way to see the effect on the shear viscosity also very clearly is, again, to look at this V2 as a function of transverse momentum. So this is, again, V2, transverse momentum. This would be a system with an F over S, which is close to zero, which is the bound. And then if you go, which is zero, and this is ideal. And this is the effect, which is the bound. It's 1/4 pi, 0.08. Here we have 2 times the bound and 3 times the bound. So you see that you have a dramatic effect on the transverse momentum dependence of this elliptic flow, depending on the shear viscosity of your own system. So this is something you can try to match with the data. And this was something which was 2 years ago was completely impossible, because people were the theory was completely unaware how to really do hydrodynamics, viscous hydrodynamics correctly. This is something which came together by a large theory effort. So that was quite important to trying to pin down the values. The other things which are important is understanding better all the uncertainties which we have. And I'll show you in the next slide that we do now understand the uncertainties better. We still are not able to really resolve them, but at least we can give estimate our errors based on the uncertainties which go in. So one of the biggest uncertainties which enters is this eccentricity, so this almond shape, because that's something which I told in the first lecture we can calculate with something like Glauber theory. So you just have nucleons, you calculate the interactions, and you get the shape of the system. You can calculate the eccentricity. And that's something which is also shown here. So this is how the eccentricity looks like. Again, for most central zero, it increases until the very peripheral collisions. If you assume that the particle production goes like this participant scaling. However, this is just a simple classical picture. If you would take a picture, what they call the color glass condensate, so if you really look at parton distributions and you have saturated parton distributions, the system actually becomes much more dense and the eccentricity becomes larger. So the fall off is larger. And that's what you see here. So these are calculations done with these saturated parton distributions. And so that's the large, you still have something like 30-40% uncertainty here in the magnitude of the eccentricity. And the flow value is proportional to this eccentricity if you have a strongly coupled system. But that transfers directly in your flow value. So that's something you have to take into account. The other thing is how to measure flow. Because I told you, you just look at the correlation of the particles with respect to this reaction plane. But this reaction plane is something which is not just given. You cannot measure the whole distribution, so you don't know exactly the reaction plane. So you have to get it from the particle distributions themselves. And what is usually done by people is to look at correlation. So if you have a distribution like this, So this is one event, and every event, of course, the reaction plane is randomly distributed. So you don't have a fixed thing. But in one event, the distribution would look like this if you would have strong flow. You have more particles going in a specific direction. And then what you can do is to look at the delta phi of two particles and make that distribution. And if all these particles are correlated with the reaction plane, basically you can, and that's the only correlation, you can write it down like this. So you just add in the reaction plane here, factorizes, and then that's equal to this T2 squared. So that's an easy thing to do to get the component. And for a distribution like this, that you can quickly see that that works. You get a V2 which is larger than zero. And, well, so if you look at the distribution versus the known reaction plane, it will be something which is bigger than zero. And if you would use an equation like this, which we denote by V22, where you use two particle correlations to calculate the V2, you would also get the same value. It would be not a problem. If you have a case where there is zero flow, try to do this symmetrically, so all the particles are going in random angles. You indeed find V2 is zero, but you would also get it from this estimate. But you can clearly see if there is additional correlation between the particles, say the resonances, jets, or even HBT correlations, you can get a different contribution, because that also enters in the two-particle correlation. And the simplest way to look at it is just if you take this thing, you double it, you just rotate it a little bit, you see that, again, this one was symmetric. You add an additional one of these to it, which is also symmetric. So in this plane, if you look at the particle distribution, it's really zero to V2. But if you apply an equation like that, you get something which is larger than zero. And that's something which we used to call non-flow effects. And that's something you have to be careful about in the analysis. And so what people now tend to do is to really make large equivalent expansions. And you look at multi-particle correlations to extract this value of V2, which is not affected by effects like this. So then you get a reliable estimate of the flow. So with more reliable estimates, we can compare to viscous hydrodynamics, and just to show that indeed it can work, and it can work very well. This is V2 as a function of centrality, which I showed you before, so the integrated flow values are measured here, and here we have the differential. And in ideal hydrodynamics, so this is the shear viscosity is pretty much zero, this thing should be a straight line, as shown here. But when you start to add in shear viscosity, you will get a dependence on the size of the system. And you see that with the shear viscosity, which is 2 times the bound, you really get a nice description of the centrality dependence of this shear component. And then if you look at the transverse momentum dependence of the same observable, so V2, you see that we had, like I showed before, a very large sensitivity. So this is an ideal fluid. 1 times the bound, 2 times the bound, and 3 times the bound. You can really describe both the transverse momentum dependence and the centrality dependence quite well with one choice of the shear viscosity. So from that statement in 2005, basically we now understand the system better, because all these viscous corrections are now being incorporated in the calculations. And we see that with parameters which we really would expect, so you take a realistic lattice equation of state, put that in your model, you use color glass condensate initial conditions, or something which you like, and a shear viscosity which is around 4 times the bound, you get a very nice description of the data. And if you, what I showed here is just the load or many more observables, which also should be sensitive. But if you start to estimate, all these things are always below 4 times the conjectured bound coming from ADS-CFT. But this is something which is for us quite exciting, and we hope to be able to really instead of giving a bound to come up with a number at some point, but that's something which still requires quite a lot of work in taking all the parameters. So that was one of the highlights of Rick. So that's the elliptic flow, this Almond and this expansion. Now I'm going to go to the other one, which is the so-called jet quenching. So one of the things we would like to do, and like to do as good as we can, is to probe the density of the system which we create in an independent way. And so normally, if you want to probe the density, you would make a station like this, a PET scanner, where you have a source of particles, of electrons, positrons, which is very well calibrated. You know exactly what goes out. And actually, in QCD, we also have that. We have something which is quite well calibrated. And that's when you have hard scattering. This is something you can calculate conservatively. And so this is something we know quite well, and we also know quite well in heavy ion collisions. The other thing then, to probe the density of the system, you have to have a probe which interacts with the medium this time. So if you would have a gamma, for instance, that would not interact with the medium, so that would not be a good probe. You need something like a quark or a gluon. And the same thing we try to do here. So we have these hard scatterings inside the heavy ion medium, and then we look what comes out and how it's modified and get an answer how dense the medium was. And if you really understand your system well, then you can make pictures like that, and that's the tomography which we all also want to do of the system which we have in heavy ion collisions. Of course, it's a little bit more complicated than this, so this is jets B plus E minus, well, we have to find them in here, so that makes life a lot more complicated. And therefore, the first thing that people do, and that's still somewhat what the status of the field is, to try to make observables which are simple. So what we do is we measure the particle yield as functions transverse momentum. We want to go to very high transverse momentum, so you have the leading particle of the jet. And we construct a ratio where you measure this yield in AA collisions, and you measure the same thing in proton-proton collisions where you don't have the medium, and you divide the two. And what you would expect in that ratio, if nothing's going on, is that here this ratio is below 1. That's the soft region due to shadowing. And then it would approach 1 in the hard region if nothing is modified in the system. So that's a simple thing to try. And this is how it looks like. So I'll plot this ratio R as a function of transverse momentum. And so this is the most peripheral collisions which we measure, 60 to 80%, which is going to pass each other if you create a very small. This is how the distribution looks like. So it's below 1 at low PT, and then it approaches 1 at higher PT. There's not too much going on. And then you start to make the collision more and more central. You see that the thing is coming down. Here you raise that, you see something. 20 to 30%, 10 to 20, 5 to 10, and these are the most central collisions. So you clearly see that instead of staying at 1, the system is starting to show a larger suppression at higher PT. This is a logarithmic scale. So we're here at 0.2, so we have a suppression of a factor of 5. These were really the first measurements of this at Rick energies. This is how it, this is actually, nowadays it's measured about up to 20 GeV, but this is a more current status. So you clearly see that this RAA factor, when you go to higher PT, is very much below 1. Again, logarithmic scale, so you have a suppression of 5 in a heavy ion collision compared to PP for the production of high PT particles. And at the same time, you can measure direct photons in a system like that and compare that to PP, and they don't interact via the strong interaction, so they should not show this effect, and indeed they also do not have that effect. So it they're at one where they should be. So that gives you some confidence in building this ratio. So you see from measurements like this that indeed the medium which is produced in heavy ion inclusion is indeed very, very dense. And if you take a model and try to say something about it, you end up with 30 to 50 times the normal nuclear density. The other way to look at the same thing is not to take one high PT particle, but try to look at something which would be like a dye jet. So now I have a very, very dense system. I have a hard scattering happening here. It's close to the surface. So one high PT particle can escape. But the other one has to go through this whole medium. So then the question is, what do you observe if you look on the other side, if you look at the delta phi correlation of two particles? And that's plotted here. So one over the number of triggers, again, the delta phi. You see here the correlation at the near side in proton-proton collisions and in gold-gold collisions. And then we go to the away side. And so in proton-proton collisions, you see the bump of the away side going the jet. And in AA collisions, at the away side, the bump comes out anymore in this PT range. So again, you have evidence for a very, very dense system. One could try to see, could argue that it's still a cold nuclear medium effect, so that the parton distributions are modified so dramatically that would explain the behavior which we see. So that's something which was tested at RIC. So in gold-gold, we have the suppression. And in PA, we expect that the suppression does not occur. The only thing which at least in this energy, should occur is something like the Cronin effect, like the multiple scattering, which would give you an enhancement. And this is what you would expect in PA if it's the final state effect in AA. If you see in PA the same thing then in AA, then of course then it's something which points just the initial state and that the PDF of the nucleus is modified. The same thing you can do for the back-to-back correlation. So we saw in AA that it's suppressed, and in PA you want to see that it stays the shape, or at best is broadened a little bit. And that's the thing you should measure. And this is what's measured from PA collisions at RIC. So again, this is the gold-gold data with the large suppression, and this is the corresponding D-gold data. And there's a reason for taking D because that's easier to collide at RIC energies. And you can even do it as a function of, for basically minimum bias, which in this case actually is rather well defined. So that's taking all the impact parameters from zero to the size of the nucleus. Or for the more central D-gold collisions. And what you see is that indeed in cold nuclear matter you get an enhancement instead of suppression. So it's really a very different effect than you really only get in the dense medium in AA collisions. The same is true also for the back-to-back correlation of jets. So here we have again this correlation plotted. Four lines is what you see in proton-proton with the same energy, same detector. Then you see D-gold. ACAA. So on the near side it's pretty much the same. We'll come back in more detail to that later. It's not completely the same. But on the away side the difference is dramatic. So PP and D gold just show your backward jet, and in gold it's gone. So again, you really have evidence for a very dense system. The same thing you can do even more differentially because we have this almond shape, so you can look at jet quenching in and out of the reaction plane. You have less medium here, more medium there, so you expect that for high PT particles they are less likely to come out in this direction than in this direction. You expect that high PT also for this V2 parameter, you expect still a relatively large value. And indeed, that's also what the data shows. So these are the measurements which one should look at. I told you before, you have these two particle or multi-particle estimates of getting the V2 out, and certainly if you have strong jet correlations, that matters. But these are the correlations with the true reaction plane, and you see that at higher PT, you very still have a significant asymmetry in the particle production that you can attribute to this jet quench. Even more, you can look at back-to-back jets as a function of this reaction plane, so you can trigger in this direction, look what comes out there, or trigger in this direction and look what's coming out in the other way. So then you can really change the size of the system where everything is going through. And you see the effects again. So the near side correlations are the same in all cases, but the away side in the system where it's going through the longest path length, it's really zero. But if you, for the more peripheral collisions, if you go and sit in the short direction, you still see something coming through. This is rather, this is just a new sigma factor, something which is marginal at the moment, but it nicely illustrates the path length dependent of jet suppression in AA collisions. So that was just simple illustrations of what is happening to just inclusive particle distribution at high PT, back-to-back jets versus this reaction plane even. But if you look at more detail and go to higher PT, there are also some extra interesting things which are observed recently. And that is, if you look at the near side correlation of a jet, so you trigger on a high PT particle, so you take well, in this case, 3 to 4, so that's not that high, 4 to 6 GeV, trigger on that particle, and you look at the correlation in delta phi, but also in delta eta. So what I showed you before was in this, so the projection here, delta phi, now we're also looking in delta eta, right, so along the beam direction. And what is observed is actually quite remarkable. So for these events, you look at the associated particles, which are from to the trigger momentum, and you see that this jet-like correlation peak is sitting on a large so-called ridge, which extends over a very long range in rapidity. And this is something nobody actually predicted. You can have some nice ideas about what this is doing. So you basically have this jet going through this medium. You have that's quite early on, so you would still have these long flux tubes of these strings in the medium, and then maybe you just carry away, you pull the whole string with you, which later fragments, and that would give something like this, and would give you this very, very long correlation length, because those things are correlated over many, many units of rapidity, which is a dramatic effect. You can look at this region, the jet-like region and the ridge, and compare it with the medium which is created. And that's something which is done here by looking at the particles which are produced, which you find inside this correlation region. You measure the protons and antiprotons there, and the pions, and you look at the ratio. And the reason why this is a nice thing to do is because we know that this proton-pion ratio in AA collisions is also heavily modified compared to PT. At these transverse momentum regions, the particle production mechanism in AA is quite different. People believe the mechanism is more like coalescence. So you have the quarks coalesce into mesons and baryons. And that gives you a much higher probability to get protons, heavy particles, protons at higher PT, because you go from the quark, the constituent quark momentum, times 3 for a proton, and only times 2 for a meson. So you get a ratio of P bar to pion, which goes above 1 in heavy ion collisions, while in proton-proton collisions, it's like this. So this is this ratio in AA collisions. This is how it looks like in proton-proton collisions, so that's just a measure thing. And then you look in the ridge, so this thing associated with the jet, but not in the peak, and you find indeed that this proton-to-pion ratio is also like the medium, like the excited medium. And if you look at this ratio, particle ratio inside the jet-like region. That's the green ones here. And you see that that corresponds again to what you see also in proton-protein collisions. So you really have something which fragments like a jet and proton-proton. That's in this region here. And here it's coming more from the media. So these are things which are measured and being studied, and the theory for this doesn't really exist yet. So it's all just speculation, but it's quite interesting. The other thing, which is even more speculative, but observed, but it's just such a nice picture of what's going on that I cannot resist showing it, is we saw the ridge at the near side from the jet, but you can also look at the away side like we did. And you can do that again as a function of this reaction plane angle. And if you now look at lower VT particles, so before you were looking at a high VT particle, say in region 6 to 10, and we looked at the away side distribution from 2 GeV and up, and we compared that to proton-proton, so we saw the suppression. But of course, there should be something going in the backward direction. So you can look at lower VT and look what is going on there in the correlation. And this is how this correlation looks like. So you have the near side peak, the away side peak. And then when you start to look in the reaction plane, and when you make this distance which is traveled the longest, you see actually that the shape of the away side peak is changing. So instead of one peak, you start to see a double hump. And the more matter you tune in, the bigger this double hump distribution becomes. And this is still something which is under debate as an experimental observer, because before you get this distribution, you have to subtract the flow contribution with the reaction plane, and that looks like this, so that also induces a little bit of this bump. But what is seen immediately already in the data before subtraction is that you have something which is first like this Gaussian, but in this case, before subtraction, is completely flat. It's really a different system. And the speculation is where you get a double hump like that is that if you have your jet, which is coming out here, you have this IPP particle going through the medium, and it's going much faster than the sound velocity through the medium. So it will actually have the same effect like another jet going faster than the speed of light, faster than the speed of sound through the air, and you have these Mach cones here. If you look at that distribution, you also see this double hump. So you're sensitive to the velocity of sound. This is rather speculative, but quite intriguing. And it fits in with the picture which we have. So if you really have an almost perfect fluid and you have a high VT particle going through, which we saw couples very strongly with this system, you get a very strong suppression. So that's all fitting in. It could induce something like a Mach shock wave through the medium. So where we are now is that we understand the source of high VT particle production rather well, because we can calculate with perturbative QCD. We can also check it with PP and PA collisions. We saw that the probes strongly interact with the medium. You see strong suppression in any way you look at it. But the thing we really want to do is to say something about the density, and then you really need to calibrate the interaction of the high VT probe with the medium. And that's something which is really ongoing at the moment. So we're looking at color factors and heavy quarks, and those are not understood. So in the picture we have, the energy loss of a fast particle going through the medium is proportional to the coupling, the Casimir, and the length squared of the system. And then you can look at things like you can try to look at energy loss of a gluon and a quark going through the medium. And they have different Casimirs. So you get a factor in energy loss, which you would expect, which is close to 2. And then you look at particles which are more produced from gluons, or particles which are more produced from quarks, and you look at the suppression. So we have here a pion and proton. So this is the pion RA, which is something you saw many times before, so that's 5 times the suppression. But if you look at protons, you see first this large enhancement in this region, but you see even at higher PT, the suppression is as best the same as for the pions. And with this picture of the color factor, you would actually expect that the suppression of the protons would be bigger than the pions. So that doesn't work out. That model is clearly not right, or we're still not in the right regime, but that's quite it's not something you would expect. But this is something we have to understand. The other thing which was proposed as an additional probe is to look at energy loss of heavy quarks going to the medium. And then a heavy quark is particularly interesting in that case because the energy loss due to the radiation of gluons is suppressed by the mass of the quark. So at lower momentum, this mass becomes important, and that is what is called this dead cone effect. So at small angles, your gluon radiation is suppressed, more heavy quarks, and so heavy quarks going through the medium are expected to lose less energy, less suppression than light quarks. And that is something you can look for. At RIC, that's at the moment quite complicated because they do not have the opportunity to fully reconstruct the D0s and other parts, so they look at just the electron spectra. But what they see is that from these measurements, the RAA from heavy quarks is pretty much the same as from light quarks. But there's no indication of this dead cone. The same thing is true for this. So this is the RAA, this is the V2, and also in the region where it's measured, one would expect that the V2 would be much, much smaller. So what we saw at RIC is that there's really a tremendous amount of striking observables coming from there. We saw the large flow in the very dense system leading to this so-called strongly interacting picture of the quark-gluon plasma, the perfect liquid. And now the theory and the measurements are really becoming more and more quantitatively, so we really would like to be able to say something about quantities like eta over S. And in the high PT sector, we're really testing this energy loss mechanism because that's not really understood yet. So in the last 15 minutes, 20 minutes, let me go to the LHC and see what we can do there. So the first change, of course, going from SPS to RIC to LHC is what you see here is this more than a factor of 10 increase in square root of S. And actually for heavy ions, this happened in a relatively short time period. So RIC started less than 10 years ago. And let me also emphasize that this thing Sven mentioned, because that was the time when I entered the field. And that was a really, really exciting period. I mean, that's the best thing one can happen to you, at least in terms of your physics career. So we hope that the same thing will happen for the LHC. And that also the same discoveries can be done. But for heavy ions, from energy, the thing which changes is the number of particles. So you go from 500 to 850. So these are the total number of particles. And for the LHC, we don't know yet. So it's a range. The time when the system will thermalize because it's much denser will be much shorter. So at the SPS, it takes 1 Fermi over C. At RIC, it's 0.2. And at the LHC, it's expected to be 0.1. So you have something which would become a QTP quite quickly. The temperature which you reach in this phase diagram, well, at the SPS, we think it's just around the critical phase transition, around TC. At RIC, we're already comfortably above. In the LHC, we're really in this range where you're probing the quantum dynamics. The energy density, remember, around 1, you have the phase transition, so this is where we think we are at the SPS. RIC, and the LHC. And actually for these numbers, this is this Bjorken estimate, so what is used is just a very conservative tau zero, which is taken one in this case. And you see if you take this value, this thing is not a factor of five higher. What is important is the lifetime of the QGP. At SPS, it's smaller than 2 Fermi over C. At RIC, it has a significant lifetime, but at LHC, it will really live for a long, long time. So, now this is the total lifetime, and of course, the system becomes bigger and bigger, going from low energy to the LHC. So it's hotter, denser, longer, and bigger. So it looks like something you would get at McDonald's. But fortunately, it's not just that. It's not just more of the same. It also becomes a really new regime. So I think Albert and one of the first lecturers explained these pictures. So if you go up in higher energies, you also are able to probe smaller values of X. And so with the LHC, we're also looking at particle production at smaller values of X. So we're looking at the different Parton distributions and perhaps get an indication of this Parton saturation. Well, this is the dynamic, so that's dominated really by the QGP. That was starting off here, and then in the whole evolution you really are affected by the equation of state, which is here, and the phase transition. You don't have to worry about this hadronic thing anymore so much. And we get new tools available. So we saw what I showed you in the plot. If you look at the PT at RIC, we're going up to 16. If you look at the most recent data, it's something like 20 GeV, but you're not able to extend that further. And if you look at things like RAA, they're flat, and they're not changing much. So you don't get too much information out of that. With the LHC, we're able to go up an order of magnitude in that range. And you get additional weakly interacting hard probes available as a reference, like the photons we saw at RIC. And so that really should allow us to get much more detailed understanding of this quark loop, gluon plasma. And of course, this is something we always have to look out for. So just to give you a few numbers, if you saw the 20 GeV at RIC, so for the LHC, with 1 month of running of heavy ions, this is the number of jets you can get from, say, 200 GeV. And that's already a significant amount. And here, 100 GeV, you really have a lot. So you can do quite detailed studies on that. The same is true for heavy quarks. So this was at the number of heavy quarks per event. This is at the SPS, so it's very small, which is useful in some cases if you don't want to be affected by this coalescence. B, of course, nothing. Here you have RIC, and this is one heavy ion event at the LHC. So you really have a lot of charm and bottom available to study. And those are, because of these electron effects, very important probes which we need. But so now we need to have a detector for that, and the biggest problem is this uncertainty in the multiplicity. So this is RIC energies, and for Alice, so now with the RIC energies, the range has reduced significantly, but still, you can have something like 1,000 or something like 3,000 particles per unit of rapidity. And a detector which you build should be able to handle that. And specifically, to cover all these probes which I've shown you, we need to be able to measure, of course, these low PT particles, which we want to look at the collective expansion of the system. So that's even around this 100 MeV or a little bit lower even. But we also need to be able to measure the high PT tracks to look at the jet quenching and things related to that. So you need a large range. Also, the particle composition, which you saw, is changing in heavy ion collisions. So the fragmentation is modified. That's something you also want to understand much better than it's done so far. So we need particle identification over this range. So from 100 MeV up to 100 GeV, we want to see what is the particle composition. And of course, these large multiplicities. And the rare probes, because these things, although they're much more abundant, you also want to be able to trigger on events like this. So you sort of see that trying to get all these things together and try to make a detector for it will either be ridiculously expensive or will give you a lot of constraints. So you'll be sort of in a crash situation. So this is what Alice came up with. This is the Alice detector. So it's a silicon detector inside. TPC. So basically you have tracking from silicon to TPC to the transition radiation detectors. And then specialized detectors to also measure muons in the forward direction. And then here, 150 meters up downstream, the ZDC system. This displays it a little bit better for when you just look at the rapidity distribution in the proton-proton collision this time. This is the multiplicity. And here you see again the different detectors. So coming from the inside, the pixel, the silicon pixel, the drifts, silicon strip detectors. This is the coverage of the TPC, transition radiation detector, time of flight, some specialized high momentum particles, and a ridge detector, calorimeters, FOSS, and MCAL, and actually some sort of leftovers from L3. And that's the mid-rapidity region where a lot of detectors cover that. And then for the more forward region, it's silicon detectors, the forward multiplicity detectors, so they measure just the particle multiplicities and our trigger detectors, V0, T0. And here you have the 0 degrees. So this is what Alice covers in pseudorapidity. So the inner tracker system is 6 layers. First 2 layers are pixels. They are fast and just give us position information. And then the third and the fourth are drift, silicon drift detectors. And they also give us information about the energy loss. And the fifth and the sixth are actually double-sided silicon strip detectors. So the parameters. And this is relevant for us because we need to be able to reconstruct the secondary vertices and the silicon detector to get the precision which we need for that. And of course it's something additional to measure these low PT particles because the radiation length, as you saw, is rather small, so it's just 8% of one radiation length. So even particles like 50 MeV will travel through this ITS, and you can do tracking at least at several points. So this is something we build in our lab, so that's why I showed this picture. This is one of the ladders of the silicon strip detectors. These are my colleagues and students testing it and putting it together. And then this thing is the one put together in the neighboring university in Utrecht. So all these ladders were put in the big silicon detector, drove it up to CERN. And then it was integrated with the pixel detectors and the drift. And then you see how it's installed in Alice, so it's really like a Russian doll, because there's very limited space available, so everything has to really be put inside each other. Actually, for placing this thing, this is this thing now wrapped in a foil, and it's sitting already at the vertex position, and this is the TPC, which is rolled out for that purpose, and then comes back in. And it's really a mess for getting all the cables out exactly. It's just extremely limited space. The other thing is the TPC, and although the ITS is really the heart of the detector, and the TPC is really the workhorse in all the heavy ion experiments. And this is a really huge device. So it's about 90 cubic meters. But you basically see the scale here. And here, this is TPC going inside the L3 magnet. But these are just to show that it exists, all the other pieces of some of the other detectors. So it's the 0 degree calorimeter, U1, the transition radiation detector, where you have six layers of tracking, time of flight, and the fossil distance. So the tracking analysis is allows us to cover this range from 0.1 to 100 GeV. And the reason why this works rather well is because there is a modest solenoidal field, which allows for rather easy pattern recognition. And with this big TPC and the ITS, you really have a long lever arm. So you get a decent momentum resolution. Just to be elsewhere, which is the thing which is important, is comparable to the other experiments. The thing which is unique for ALICE is really the small material budget. So if you start from the vertex to the end of the TPC, just 10% of the radiation. So then you're not affected by too many the stuff which is produced along the way, which you already had enough. And the tracking is then done by six layers of silicon, then the TPC, which gives you 160 space points, and then the transition radiation detector. So you have very nicely defined track. And this is how it behaves, at least in simulation so far. So this is the efficiency as a function of transverse momentum. This is the region which is mostly complicated for us. The TPC acceptance is 90%, so that's the line where you should think of. And this is the efficiency, so we pretty much have 100% efficiency in the reconstruction. And you can combine it with the other detectors, and those are mainly geometrical effects. The momentum resolution is quite good. If you take all that combined, the TPC alone wouldn't be able to bring you out to 100 GeV with a decent momentum resolution. But if you combine also the whole ITS, you get a momentum resolution, which is around 5% at 100 GeV, which is sufficient for our goals. The particle identification then in ALICE, we're really using pretty much every technique which is available. So we use DPX and TPC, time of flight, roundage, Rankoff, ridge, transition radiation, calorimeters, and Muon spectrometer. And you see that for 5KP, the identification, of course, can be done at low momentum with the TPC and IDS, which is quite easy, just set the log. Then you get the region where things start to overlap in the TPC. That's where the time of flight works quite well. So you have separation of K pi to something like 3 GeV. You have a small region for the ridge. Here you have the TRD. But even at the much larger momentum, this TPC has an energy DDX resolution, which is good enough to disentangle the particles at high P. So you saw that the design resolution was something like 5%, and that allows you to do particle identification with the TPC region here. That's similar to the techniques used at lower energies for the first experiments, which I showed you, like NF49, because there were fixed targets, so all the particles had very, very large momenta, and there you could also do the same thing. So it has been done before. This is pretty much a random day in ALICE when they were called up to take a picture. And this is really the people who were working on ALICE at that point in time. So everybody came together. And this was for us the end of installation in 2008. And at that point, we were looking at some of the things we could already do. So taking cosmics and looking at the resolutions, and look in the TPC as a function of momentum for the tracks and look at the different particles, and you get the handle of the DPX already. And we saw that it pretty much was as good as the design goal, which is good. Transverse momentum resolution, so if you have these cosmics going through the TPC, it's one straight line, but of course you can see it as two separate tracks here, so you can get a handle on how well you reconstruct them and get the momentum resolution out of it. And then you see that at 10 GeV, it's around 10%. So that's PPR design is 5%, so that has to be calibrated, and I believe that has been done at this point in time. It was not just cosmics, which Alice saw. We also saw a lot of stuff coming from various places. The first one was a big surprise. That was in June 15 already. That's when they were just circulating the beam in the SPS, and then at some point they've done with it. And that was not announced, but in Alice we saw at one point that all the detectors were gone. And later on, when looking at the displays and reconstructing it, we saw these big sprays of particles going through the detectors. Later on, we had the injection test. At that point, it was always announced when there would be a dump, so we could turn off some of the detectors, which we were afraid of, that they would be damaged. And of course, we saw the circulating beams in September. And actually, we saw a real interaction in the LHC. This is a proton-silicon collision. This happened when the beams were circulating, and that was at the point when they were really going rounds many thousands of times already per second. And at some point, a proton came out of the beam pipe, and you can see these are the tracks which are produced, but here you can look in more detail. So this is one of the silicon pixel detectors, and that's the vertex which we found from these tracks. So there's an interaction here, and then a lot of these OPT tracks are produced. This is in the ITS, and this is in the longitudinal direction. So that was our first collision. So that brings me to the summary. You saw that with heavy ion experiments, really get access to the properties of matter at extreme densities and temperatures. And there's quite a lot to learn still. And the LHC is our next chapter, and it's really, again, an order of magnitude higher in energies than what we had before. So that's something which is very, very exciting, and Alice is ready for studying this. Thank you.
Thanks, Raymond. Thanks in particular for a special request we had last week to include the Alice detector line, so that was very nice to see. Okay, so any questions?
Yes. So one of the simplest triggers we have for AA collisions are coming from the CDCs. So there you decide what centrality of the collision. So if you want to trigger on central collisions, that's the detectors which you would use for that. But the other, we have also a high-level trigger system, and that does the full reconstruction. So that does allow you, again, to get a trigger from the muon system, for instance. And
then so what is your event rejection? So how many do you keep?
that will depend on the luminosity. So I don't know the numbers by heart.
And when the LHC is running, if it's running on lead iodine, do you have different bunch spacing, or do you also stay in the same
I think it's the same.
Bunch spacing is the same. Our luminosity, since they will increase the beam inside, and then the new PP will reach 10 to the 30. It is supposed to be the highest on luminosity in Alice. In the lead will be 10 to the 26. If I remember, 10 to the 27. So but the bunch spacing is the same. Only lead spacing. Increase the beam size. Emma, you mentioned that the beam is equal to
the? Ah, okay. So, yeah. So that's one of the ways of trying to figure out what the size of the system is. So, if two pions, for instance, are coming from a system, you can look at the interference of the two pions at the both and then you basically can get a handle on the size of the system. So if they're far away, the interference is different than closer. That's the that's the HPT, or the femtoscopy as it's called nowadays. It was available and it worked for our purposes. So yeah, I think if you would have to put in a new magnet, that's quite a lot of money, and we don't really need a superconductive thing, and we need something which is big to contain the TPC.